Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. So the Winter Olympics are coming up next month in South Korea, coinciding with this moment of public reckoning with sexual misconduct, including assault. And the Olympics haven't been immune. One of the team doctors for USA Gymnastics was just sentenced to 60 years in prison for molesting more than 100 women and girls, including Olympic gold medalists Michaela Maroney, Allie Raisman, and Gabby Douglas. Swimming, taekwondo, and U.S. speed skating have had their own scandals. Joining us now are Alexandra Starr, WNYC reporter, who has documented sexual exploitation in the Olympics for Harper's last fall, and Bridie Farrell, former elite speed skater and founder of the advocacy organization New York Loves Kids, to talk about the abuse that many young athletes face at the hands of their coaches and even doctors. Hi, Alexandra, and welcome to WNYC. Bridie.
Hi.
Hello.
Alexandra, one of the athletes you talk about in your Harper's piece is Deborah Denethorne. How is her story emblematic of the abuse that so many others have also faced who are young athletes?
So Deborah was an elite swimmer in Northern California and had been identified at a very young age as someone who could make it to the Olympics. Her coach, Andy King, insisted when she was 12 that she start practicing in the morning and afternoon. So that meant she was spending about 4 to 5 hours a day with him. And he started grooming her for a sexual relationship at that age. It turned out years later that he had raped 14 of his athletes over the course of 2 decades. Yes. And what was sort of emblematic and very upsetting about that story is that there had been reports about his behavior. And what happened was he would just go to another pool. He would go to another swim club. And when it came to light that USA Swimming, the very highest levels of USA Swimming, had been aware of his behavior and shrouded it instead of going public, it was a big scandal. And that happened in 2010. He's now serving a 40-year sentence.
And have heads rolled in USA Swimming for sweeping it under the rug?
Good question. The head of USA Swimming at the time, Chuck Wielgus, had presided over this golden age for USA Swimming. They had won well over 150 medals. Now, a lot of that was because his tenure coincided with Michael Phelps, right? So you can't say it was all due to him. But he had a lot of support within the USOC, the U.S. Olympic Committee, and within the swimming organization itself. So he was never fired. He died last year, and he was not allowed to enter the USA Swimming Hall of Fame. A lot of the victims organized and prevented him from, you know, being so honored. So in that sense, there were repercussions. There are now 150 swim coaches who are on the so-called banned list.
That's a lot.
It is a lot. And
it
one of them
shows the pervasiveness of the problem.
Absolutely. And one of them was the former U.S. Nationals coach. Yes. I mean, it is kind of striking, yes, how pervasive it is, and then for so long that these people were not held accountable.
Bridie Farrell, thank you again for coming in and joining Alexandra and me. You have your own story to tell in addition to the advocacy work that you're doing with this group now. Can you tell us some of your own story?
Certainly. So I grew up in Saratoga Springs, New York, just north of Albany, where I grew up short track speed skating. And my coach was the best in the country. So a lot of people would come to Saratoga to train. And in fact, Andy Gable, who was the most decorated speed skater at the time, moved to Saratoga to train as we were both training for the 1998 Olympic trials. And it's the same story. Like, my story is the same as so many others that I hear that he was really helpful to me. I was the up-and-coming skater, so I didn't get a lot of attention, but he really helped me with my blades and technique and all, you know, all that stuff, and made me feel like I had a chance at coming to the top. So I was molested repeatedly, I mean, multiple times a week to a couple times a day for months until he ultimately made the Olympic team and left and then retired from speed skating, to which people said, well, why didn't I come forward the next year? He eventually went on to be the president of USA Speed Skating. Mm. He was very involved with SLOC, the Salt Lake Olympic Committee, and he moved up to being one of the top folks for the ISU, the International Skating Union.
And you're sitting on this horrible information about him with respect to you while he's moving up the ranks.
And I was still competing. I kept skating through 2006. And even at the 2000 World Championships in Beijing, China, he was there as president of US Speed Skating and came up to me and cornered me and said, like, have you told anyone? Did you tell? And so,
wow.
I mean, he knew it was wrong.
He even confronted you to pressure you into keeping
these
secrets.
Right.
That, which seems like it took an incredible amount of nerve to ask you that. Like, that could have prompted you to go public right then.
Exactly. But it was more, I was never the number one speed skater. I wasn't Apollo Ohno. I was always on the cusp of on and off the team. So I didn't feel that I was able to tell my story and be safe still on the team. And a lot of my motivation skating, yes, as a little girl, I always wanted to make the Olympic team. But I always wanted to win a gold medal because I thought then I would be able to tell my story.
And you finally went public in 2013. Why then?
I took 7 years off of skating. I grew up, went to school, all that good stuff, and then decided to go back after 7 years and try out for the long track Olympic team. And I was living and skating in Milwaukee for only about a month and was approached by actually Mitch Tyke from the Milwaukee NPR, and I trusted him. He wanted to do a radio blog leading up to the trials, and there's this little girl, her name's Claire, at the Milwaukee rink who I just saw myself in her. She looked up to the top skaters, Bonnie Blair, who would come to the rink, Shawnee Davis. And I knew that I could never prosecute Andy and that the statute of limitations had expired in New York State. My fear was being sued for defamation of character. But I knew that the worst that I went through, I did not want anyone and that little girl Claire to. So I knew it was important just to tell my story.
Wow. Alexandra, what are you thinking?
It sounds so familiar. You know, Deborah Dennethorne, whom you mentioned, did not go public until she was pregnant with a little girl. It's oftentimes not until they become adults that victims of child sexual abuse, people who have been abused as children, come forward and tell their story. And what's ironic is that oftentimes at that point, there really isn't any legal recourse for them. Like in a state like New York, for example, the deadline for coming forward with a criminal or civil case, you have to be 23 or under after that. There's not much that can be done.
So there's an age limit, and Bridie, you referred to the statute of limitations. So is that an issue, lengthening the statute of limitations?
Yeah, it's a huge issue. And I think that if there's ever a time to talk about it, it's certainly now. And something that I keep saying is kids too, as well, because the average age that a survivor of childhood sexual abuse speaks up is in their 40s. So an age of 23 is, one, insulting, but two, it's ineffective because these predators don't have one victim. They have many. I came forward, and the following week, another woman came forward, and we know of more. So it's not just, for me, it's not a battle of me getting justice. It's about stopping this behavior to protect the next child.
My guests are WNYC reporter Alexandra Starr, who has also documented sexual exploitation in the Olympics for Harper's Magazine last fall, and Bridie Farrell, former elite speed skater and founder of the advocacy group New York Loves Kids, and you've been hearing her tell some of her own story. And we can take a few phone calls for them with questions about them and their work or your own story. Are you an athlete who's competed or hoping to compete at the Olympic level, or maybe you have a child who's won, or if you've competed at any level at all in school or anything, even not Olympics bound, how do you think the pressure of being an athlete affects the way you report abuse or anything related that you want to say or ask? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Bridie, does the emphasis on pushing limits as a young athlete make young athletes more vulnerable to this abuse in any way?
I think so. I'm one of six kids, and my mom said to me, find a ride to the rink. And so I did. And I didn't have a driver's license. I didn't have any money. The only currency I had was myself and my body. And I wanted to do this so much. I mean, I was waking up at god-awful hours in the morning and skating late at night when we get ice time. And so it is bizarre to say now, but it was seemed as if it was just kind of part of the deal and part of the sacrifice. And you continually want to push yourself. And also, by the time that you're in this sexual abuse thing, I mean, it's all about power. And so you're scared to leave. I mean, would my parents let me go back to the rink? What would happen? Would anyone believe me? I was afraid of my father's business. I was afraid of how people would retaliate against my siblings. All that stuff. I mean, my mom's a piano teacher. Was she going to use pianos? Like, that's so terrible for a high school kid
terrifying.
To be thinking of. But also, I was trying out at the top level of the sport, and I'm talking now from the top level. It's, I think, that the lower ranks where it's even harder for athletes and young athletes to come forward.
Alexandra, you used a word before talking about Deborah Denethorn, and I think you used it in your Harper's piece too, groomed, that the coach was grooming her for a sexual relationship. And you've written that many young athletes don't even realize they've been abused. Maybe they're young and inexperienced enough that they don't know the difference between abuse and consent. Or can you expound on that and talk about what you mean there?
Sure. So what happened to Deborah was Andy King really became part of her family. So he, like for Bridie, he was driving her to and from the pool. He made a point of trying to cage an invitation to dinner every night. So her parents took to just like putting out a plate for him. And you can see what they're doing when you're outside of it, right? They are trying to preempt any questions that might surface in the parent's mind because this person is so helpful. This person is really part of our family. It was striking to me when I first interviewed Bridie. I feel like I should let you say this, but Andy Gable started taking piano lessons from her mother.
Wow.
Her father became his doctor in Saratoga Springs. Like, this is a pattern of behavior, and it's so nefarious, right? Because when you're in it, it's very hard to identify. But this is the way they go about it. This is how they find their victim and then groom their victim and the extended family.
Anything to add, Bridie?
Well, also about victims not knowing. So I stopped skating competitively when I was 24 and transferred to Cornell. And I took a class when I was 26 years old about human development, and we had to write a paper about what we learned in the class and how it applies to your life. In that class, we learned how a teenage brain can't distinguish between consent, and that's why there's these laws, et cetera. That was the first time I realized that a crime had been committed, that it wasn't my fault, that it was all these things. So it's just the whole thing, I don't even have words for it, but to say that someone has to come forward by age 23 or that a 15-year-old is supposed to speak up and get out of this, I mean, I was at Cornell and didn't know this.
And to someone who might ask, wait, if someone was doing something to you that you didn't want them to do physically, how could you be confused about what that is?
Well, I had to get to the rink. Like, I'm not sure I was a fan of my lawn mowing business, but I had to do that and earn $12 a lawn, right? So, like, it's just part of the deal.
You know, And I think sports, and elite sports in particular, really can inculcate a mindset of this is all about sacrifice. When I spoke to gymnasts, I mean, the kind of pain they push through on a daily basis just completely boggles the mind. And I think someone like Dr. Larry Nassar knows this. And it allows them to sort of push the envelope and push the limit past the point where we should feel physically safe. But they have, in a way, been groomed by the sport, you know, not to know where those limits are.
Let's take a phone call. Wendy in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Wendy, thank you so much for calling.
Hi, thank you for the conversation. I'm listening, and I totally agree with what you're discussing about athletes sort of being primed for this sort of act to be preyed upon for this. But as a swimmer, as an athlete, as a dancer, with a brother who was in the Catholic Church, you know, I know that we are having problems in these different arenas, and I am a little bit wary of us, or not us, because you're having the right discussion. But what I often hear is, oh, it's just the swimmers. Oh, it's just the Catholic Church. Oh, it's just the football team. Oh, it's just, and now I think we are at a time where we realize, no, it's all our children. It's everywhere. And I was just listening thinking, oh my God, I hope we really get to the point where we discuss that we're not keeping our children safe. And athletes, I think, are particularly vulnerable. I mean, I am used to a very high level of pain and put myself through certain things, just like, you know, the woman speaking and certain things. But I know now with my own child, it's everywhere. And we often hear, oh, it's just this, it's just that, or you're being too anxious. And I think we know now in this time, thank goodness, and I hope we can discuss this, that it's really, it's pretty much everywhere. And we, so we're not being over anxious to say that.
So what will you do as a parent, Wendy, if you want your own kids, especially daughters, if you have daughters, but I mean, certainly this has hit boys too. If you want them to have these experiences, but you see how pervasive this is across different sports and et cetera, will you just keep them cloistered, or what's a solution for a parent if you've thought about that?
That's such a good question, and I'm lucky I have a 4-year-old at the moment, and I've been thinking about it, and I can't keep her cloistered, and I can't with my experiences, I can't completely just give up and let her go, which so many people around me are doing and saying, oh, you're just over worrying. We have to really be present, and we have to think. And for me, it was recently one of our schools wanted the girls to be alone with 12-year-old boys. And I had to stand up and say, I'm sorry I'm being so anxious, but for me, that is completely where my traumatization happened. As I don't know if the children should be putting the school through this, or, you know, I think we need to think about this. Do they really need to be without adult supervision? Can't we, you know, we can trust, but we need to think about this. And we have to stand up and just think, you know, they're all good kids. They're all good people, but they might have a problem, and we need to kind of, you know, check and see and be aware and look. I mean, our kids are vulnerable to this, and it keeps happening and happening and happening.
Yeah.
And on a personal level, I don't want to scare my daughter. I don't want to cloister. I know other friends who are saying, don't let anyone touch your body. They're making a problem out of it. But there has to be somewhere in the middle. But if we're all not talking about it, and we think everything is completely safe and anyone who speaks up is crazy, this is going to keep happening. And, cause, you know, and I was told at the school, this is my favorite part, that their boys were exceptional.
Oh.
And that they were special. And this is a progressive institution in Manhattan that we pay quite a bit of money for. I had to breathe calmly and say, you know, no, no one's special anymore. And they really actually sat down and thought about it, thank God, and got the whole school together and spoke about it. But we're 2018, and we're listening to the exceptionalism of boys and girls in a time where almost every day we're listening to the private schools, the swim teams, the skating teams, the Catholic Church, everything for years now. And we know there's nothing exceptional here.
Bridie Farrell, does this touch on the work that your advocacy group, New York Loves Kids, does? And is there any, you know, advice you can offer to Wendy and the many other parents who are obviously identifying with this call?
Yeah, I mean, Wendy calling in just makes me think of so many things. First, the terrible stat that 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 6 boys are abused by 18. So it is both genders. And The other thing that I always like to say is that there were so many, 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 many wonderful people that helped me throughout my skating career. And because some people will go the extreme and proposed a law that said that no coach could be with an athlete under 18 alone. And in the case of speed skating, like, you have to meet with your coach because the coach will have multiple competitors in the same race. So that one-on-one time is important. My sister is a professional ballerina in LA, and same thing, like, there's one-on-one training. So it's a matter of, I think, having the relationship between the child and some adult that they're able to be open and discuss it. But I personally don't think the, you know, just hold the child at home and lock them up, which is exactly what Wendy's saying, that she still wants her daughter to get out there. I mean, it's a tough situation, but I do feel that with Me Too, we are seeing, like, first it was entertainment, and it's going through the whole thing. I mean, I think I'm kind of the only winter athlete that has really come forward, and maybe they'll keep coming more, but where it's not immune. Like, child sexual abuse is not just in one industry. It's not by one gender. It's not by race. I mean, one of my best friends was abused at 3. Mm. So it is young baby. Like, it is the whole, yes. You know, and it's terrible. But the only way for us to change it as a culture is to discuss it. And there are some women that abuse children, but predominantly it's men. And Jackson Katz is an amazing person in this field. And he really says, like, how are we raising our men and boys that this is acceptable behavior? And our boys, these might be wonderful boys, but they are not special enough that they get access to free girls. Like, boys and girls should be able to be in a room alone, but discuss what that means. And, you know, boys will be boys. No, boys, raise boys to be good humans.
One of the things I was just thinking, Brian, is you asked me what would I do with my daughter. Uh-huh. And one of the things I have been doing with my I've been told that she's beautiful, she's adorable, every day since she was born, I speak up and I say she's strong and smart,
yep.
too. And I, you know, again, I thought that in 2013, 14, 15, 16, 17, you know, thought we would be past this. I try to redefine it for her. I speak to people and say, please, you know, let's think about this. She's sort of getting too much attention for this. Let's think about it. But also, you know, we are living in a time where the children are told to kiss. The children are told to hug. The children are told, you know, basically, you don't have a say over what you do physically. And we need to teach them that it's up to them if they want to share themselves in another way. And I think it starts from the beginning. And yep. I see so many people that this is with their nannies or whoever, you know, oh, do this, do this. They're learning that they don't have control over their own body. And I think we can start there. It's your body. These are your privates. These are your things, without scaring them so much that we give them a complex. But it's not their job to kiss everybody. It's not their job to hug everybody. It's not their job to, you know, we can't laugh if they're half naked in the park. We have to think about these things. We can't yell at them, but you know, we have to start thinking about, as children, you know, this is you, that you can stand up to this. And these are your things. This is not for somebody else to take advantage of. And with little girls, we're still in 2018 telling them and defining them with their beauty, with their loveliness, with whatever, and we need to teach them, you're strong, you can stand up to this. I certainly didn't get that. I got, oh, you're so cute, this is this. Yeah, well, we can stop that now. It's 2018, and we're all standing up, thank goodness, and I don't want that for my daughter, and I'm going to... putting martial arts on the list, and also letting her know
what's your sport, little girl.
Nobody touches
martial arts. Wendy, thank you so much for such an important call, and I'm sure so many parents and others listening right now are thinking, there is one great mom. So,
oh, no,
thank
I know, but thank you.
Thank you
very
much.
Thank you for discussing
much.
This, but we're going to keep them safe. We're going to move on in 2018, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Thank you very much. And let me go to another caller, Gedney in Brooklyn. Gedney, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. This was touched on a little bit in the previous comments, but I was just wondering if there's been any research about how women do with standing up to abuse or talking about it when they're in a team sport. I know the two examples that have been given are swimming and speed skating, which has been pointed out involves a lot more one-on-one coaching time. Did anything change for athletes once they got on a team and could talk to other women about it, or does that
great,
help?
Great question. Alexandra, safer on team sports?
Yeah, that is a great question. It does seem as though certain sports lend themselves more to one-on-one time with a coach, as you were saying. And that makes, if you're grooming someone for a sexual relationship, you can see how that lends itself, right? That kind of dynamic that you and I are going to be working one-on-one. Not only that, I'm the arbiter of your worth. I'm the arbiter of how you're progressing, whether you have a future. In particular, I do get the impression, and this isn't a study, because to be honest, there haven't been that many studies when it comes to sexual abuse in sport, but I do get the impression that in these sports where the selection process is subjective. So say, you know, if you compare gymnastics, say, to running, you know, in running, if you run the fastest 50-yard dash, you're going to make the team. In gymnastics, it's much more subjective. Not only that, so the scoring is subjective, but then even the process to select the athletes for the team is subjective, because in some cases, they won't even go by the scoring. They'll say, you know what? X person is injured, so we're not going to take her this time. That provided an opening for someone like Dr. Nasser, right? Because he knew what was ailing these female athletes. And he made a comment in a podcast he did where he said, you know, I'm very careful in revealing that information, because if I lose the athlete's trust, she will tell her teammates and then they won't trust me. So you can see how he manipulated the system so that he could have this unfettered access to these young girls. So yes, to your point, I did get the impression that when it came to, say, cross-country running, there were many fewer stories than you hear in gymnastics. And this might sound strange, but Taekwondo is a really bad defender.
Oh, and the previous caller was
terrible.
Saying, oh, martial arts, haha. But you're saying even in the martial art of Taekwondo.
Absolutely.
Why?
Well, that's a very good question. But it turns out the former U.S. coach has been accused of raping several of the women he was coaching. His brother, who is an Olympic medalist, has been accused of targeting and grooming young girls. So in a way, no sport is immune, I guess, is one of the takeaways.
This is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. We are New York and New Jersey Public Radio, as we finish up with Alexandra Starr, WNYC reporter, who also documented sexual exploitation in the Olympics for Harper's last fall, and Bridie Farrell, former elite speed skater and founder of the advocacy group New York Loves Kids, who's been telling her story here and elsewhere since 2013. And Bridie, a last word from you. I think maybe you wanted to add something to what Alexandra was just saying. But also, I'm just imagining all these parents listening to this, even though this came up already explicitly during the conversation, and just thinking, nothing's safe.
Well, so a few things. One about Taekwondo. I was recently in Colorado Springs Airport, which I used to live in Colorado Springs. That's where the Olympic Training Center is. And I saw these guys with the Taekwondo helmets. And I went up to them, and I was like, are you Taekwondo? And they said, yeah, I just got back from the World Championships. And I said, my name's Bridie Farrell. And they go, hi. And I was like, okay, you know who I am. If you need anything, call me. Because it's so prevalent in Taekwondo, but they can't talk within their own sport. It's so small, right? So to tell these people that you can call someone outside of the sport is huge. About signing your kid up to take martial arts, like, we need to stop having female self-defense courses and how to hide a handgun in your purse. Like, humans need to be humans. Like, just be nice people. I don't understand how that, if you don't want to say this in front of your mother, like, don't say it. You know, like, that shouldn't be that much of a golden rule to go by. One quick thing is that I know with the speed skating junior team, they suggested that going forward, it should be the boys' team, and then the girls' team will have a one-to-one ratio of a supervisor. And I was like, are you kidding me? Like, why don't we sit those three boys down and tell them to be good people? Like, if you want to have safe streets, you don't give all the pedestrians helmets. Teach people to drive.
But telling boys to be good people sounds like weak tea for stopping sexual abuse.
Yeah. And I think that, like, once these guys are seeing that even the toughest top guys in the industry are falling, then there are repercussions. And on the flip side, there was people with Matt Lauer who knew that he was doing these grown men making millions of dollars, and they were too intimidated to come forward. How do you expect the woman in that situation? How do you expect a kid? Right? So, yeah, it is tricky, but I would put my kids in speed skating. I love it. There are ultimately so many good people. It's a great sport. I would put my kids in so many things. And I don't know what it is about me, but I innately believe that people are good, and we really need to tap into that.
Bridie Farrell, founder of the advocacy organization related to this, New York Loves Kids, and WNYC's Alexandra Starr. Thank you so much for such an important segment.
Thank you. Thank you.